Good evening and welcome to Sissel Recital Hall on the MSU Billings campus for this live broadcast to discuss the current state of political discourse. I'm Jackie Yamanaka of Yellowstone Public Radio. This is not a new subject, but it seems that not much has changed. And some would even argue it's worse, meaner. U.S. Senator John McCain earlier this year said, quote, "Let's trust each other. Let's return to regular order." He was talking about the effort to repeal and replace Obamacare. And the Arizona Republican added, quote, "We've been spinning our wheels on too many important issues because we keep trying to find a way to win without help from the other, from across the aisle." Regular order, what is it? It's boring, right? It's the process and procedures that have governed the U.S. Senate for generations. And NPR's senior political correspondent Ron Elving says it's more than that. It's also a state of mind that presumes a degree of bipartisanship. It's a willingness to debate, to agree and disagree in committee. And in other words, is the lack of regular order a sign of incivility? So that's what we're going to discuss tonight, and that's where our two guests come in. I want to welcome former U.S. Senators Al Simpson of Wyoming. Thank you very much for coming from Cody. And of course, U.S. Senator and former U.S. Senator and former U.S. Ambassador to China, Max Baucus of Montana. Welcome to our guests.
Thank you.
So roughly for the next hour, we're going to talk about the current state of discourse, and we're going to focus on the U.S. Senate because that is where these two gentlemen served. We're going to talk about the current state. We're going to talk about what it used to be like when these two statesmen were in the U.S. Senate. And then finally, we'll conclude with, can this situation be fixed? Or are we doomed? Are we doomed to continue on this path? So I'd like to begin with the two gentlemen and asking them to share their stories. First off, would you agree with the observation by some political scientists that deviating from regular order is a sign of incivility? Max, would you like to jump in?
Well, fine. Yeah, thanks, Jackie. First, thanks, Jackie, NPR. We're honored, Al, to have you and Ann here, your wife. We sometimes think you're really from Montana because you come shopping so frequently.
Oh, the cat's out of the bag.
And I want to just also acknowledge my wife, Melody's here, and also my son, Zeno, and his wife, Stephanie. Very honored to have them here too. I think to answer your question, number one, I think it is worse, no question, than it's been in the past. And I think there are a lot of reasons for it. In my judgment, a lot of it is the rise of communications technologies and social media with a deluge of outlets of information broadcasting. And as a consequence, people can say more irrespective of the truth than they could possibly in the past. Many people harken back to the Huntley-Brinkley days and Walter Cronkite days with just a couple, three networks that kind of brought us all together as a country. We'd watch the evening news and they kind of filtered things out a little bit, we're together. But now, I think that with a plethora, this the proliferation of media, whether it's blogs, whether it's all the networks, cable, you name it, it's just much easier for somebody to say something that's not true, and it's, if it's not true, so much the better for some people, and that just makes things very, very difficult. Back in the older days, when Al and I were there, let me be very brief here, yes, we did a lot more together. I think regular order is more of a state of mind, frankly, than I do actual rules. I think diagrams and flowcharts, rules, are all very important. But if people want to work together, you know, they can, irrespective of the diagrams and flowcharts and things. But things have changed a little bit. And I'll stop there because I want to hear what Alan has to say, but it's more coarse, no question.
Sure. I just want to say, for those of you in the audience, think of regular order. Do you remember, some of you remember Schoolhouse Rock, how a bill becomes a law? That's kind of what we're talking about here. And if you haven't, you should look for it on YouTube. Should mention, Al, regular order, is the deviation from regular order, is that incivility?
Well, first, it is a pleasure to be here. And Max and I were elected together the same year, 78. And my father served with Mike Mansfield. And so when I came, Dad was in the U.S. Senate for 4 years. When I came, he said, you know, get to know that guy Baucus. I see he got elected up there and you're there. And Mike and I used to work together. It's important you do that. And we did. But it's totally different. The coin of the realm was trust. Yeah. And that coin is severely tarnished. There is no trust whatsoever, even within a party. There is no trust within the members of their own party. And regular order was simply that if you had an amendment and you went to the leaders on the floor and said, who's next? Who's coming up next? Well, Baucus has an amendment. Oh, nowadays they say, oh, well, we don't like that, so they just junk it. Or Simpson would have an amendment, and that ruins, it makes people bitter that somebody has judged that their amendment isn't worth voting. Even if you lost it 80 to 20, you want to state your case. You can't do that anymore. It's waste. And then someone will say, well, we're going to filibuster that. Well, there is a way to break that, and it's called bring a cot. But they don't bring a cot anymore.
Not anymore. Even SJ. Yeah, right. That's changed.
Remember that. And Dole, which you say, going to be filibuster? Well, okay, gang. Get the sergeant-at-arms, get the cots, and we're here till you break the filibuster.
Now, currently, I mean, let's talk a little bit about the current backdrop that we're seeing in the U.S. Senate where, again, they're procedural, right? The filibuster, the hold. These used to be extreme measures to say, hey, now, wait a minute here. They've become almost run-of-the-mill for legislation, which is, we're not talking about tax reform here. We're just talking about maybe reauthorization of the FAA, for example, or highway reauthorization. We're coming up again on a new farm bill. But now these procedural tactics, I suppose you'd call it, is just the way to absolutely bring things to a grinding halt.
Well, I might say, they have always been there.
True.
The rules, the holds, everything's always been there. The difference is, back in the older days, there was more trust. We would not utilize those procedural provisions that are available because we wanted to work together more of the time. Today, those same rules are being taken advantage of by people want to block, stop, for narrow partisan political purposes, not to get good public policy enacted. That's the main difference. But those rules have been there.
Well, they are, and they reduced the filibuster from 60. When Dad was there, they took it down about 5.
Yeah.
And it sounds, but it's an automatic fanny-kicking machine. You hate it when you're getting hit in the mouth with it, but you love it when you're doing the hitting. And it has to work because the Senate is to preserve a minority sometimes within a minority. And if that ever changes, so far I don't think it has, but it's abused terribly. Yeah. And the hold, I remember how frustrated Byrd and Dole were. Well, who put the hold on this bill? Well, I'm sorry, it's confidential. Well, we of the body said, we don't care, who is it? And then you go to the guy and say, will you get that turkey off of here so we can move this bill? That's what you did. Nowadays, you know.
But even back then, it took a lot of work. I can remember sitting on the floor myself, but more watching Reed or the leader working on somebody trying to get our senator to reduce a hold. Man, oh man, oh man.
How about Metzenbaum?
Metzenbaum is a good example.
Metzenbaum would sit there, he's crouched like a raptor on the edge of a cliff. And he knew that Stevens was going to try to put a new something in Alaska, a railroad train or whatever, and he'd object. And Stevens would just get as red as that seat. And, it was fun to watch, but it was not pleasant.
Let's talk about an issue which is front and center in the news right now, tax cuts. Max, you were involved in that. In fact, you angered members of your own party. Right now, the struggle is it's one party that has the burden. They don't even appear to reach out to the other side. So I want to give you both a chance to weigh in on this of, is it really the responsibility of the party in charge to do that? And then if they are not accepting amendments and suggestions from the other party, what that means for the public discourse?
Well, I was lucky to be on the Finance Committee good number of years, and chaired that committee for a good number of years. That committee has a history of bipartisanship, that we work together. And partly it's because when you're dealing with taxes, you can add, raise a tax here, lower it there. But the code is so complicated, there's a way to kind of work things out, but we're very bipartisan. Over time, unfortunately, that began to change. And I first noticed it, not on a tax bill, but ACA, Affordable Care Act. I was then chairman, and I was so proud of us working together. We're gonna get a bipartisan health care reform bill through. Almost 15 months we worked on that bill. It was bipartisan. Republicans, Democrats on the committee, we had little groups, and we'd focus on Medicaid, then over here on Medicare, hospital reimbursement, and you name it. And because we're searching to try to find how does all this work? At that time, senators had no idea what our healthcare system was. So that was an opportunity to try to figure out what it was. Slowly, slowly, slowly put a bill together. I had several rules. One is everything's on the table. Number two, if you have a problem, bring a solution, and so on and so forth. And it was working real well until finally we got to the point where we started to vote in the committee on a bill. And slowly I could feel it start to slip away. What was the slippage? My judgment, I don't know if Alan agreed to this, it was almost total partisanship. The other body, Mitch McConnell, others, wanted to do all they could, did not let that bill pass. It was mostly politics, entirely politics. Mostly politics. And they prevailed. Not one Republican voted for the bill. We started off trying to make it totally, totally bipartisan, and it ended up being totally, totally partisan. So over time it slipped. Sometimes I vote with Republicans. I put together the Medicaid Part D, Medicaid reimbursement bill. Not very many Democrats supported. I put it together because the right thing to do, that is, seniors should get prescription drug benefits. Not just have to go to the hospital to get drug benefits, but their doctor could prescribe them. And man, oh man, I got my head taken off by an awful lot of Democrats. But I don't want to pat myself on the back. It's the right thing to do, and it did it. Guess what? All those Democrats now who were upset with me, you think they'd vote against that bill today? They love it. It's the right thing to do. But anyway, you got to stand up sometimes.
Well, if you're a leader, you're going to irritate people. And if you don't irritate people, get out of the business. And Max had an ability to do that, and I did too.
Yeah, Alan did. I was both irritate and lead.
Max and I always didn't have the most sweet disposition, but we always got back together because if you can't forgive a person, it's like letting them live in your head rent-free. Don't ever forget that one. And hatred corrodes the container it's carried in. And there's plenty of hatred in this country, and it goes right into the Congress. And it's not called disgust, it's called hate. I hate Hillary, I hate Trump, I hate this guy.
Hate Obama. That's driven a lot.
You bet. And that's the way it is, and you can't wish it away, but what did happen when it fell apart is now what just happened the other day. Not one Democrat voted for this package. Nobody knows what's in it. Nobody knew much except Max what was in the Affordable Care Act. But the point is, you cannot do that. To do a piece of legislation that's of merit, it takes 6 or 8 years to do a bill that everybody in America can get their hooks into, and that takes time, hearings and all the rest of it. And so the other day, there it was, straight up and down, party shot, and so the argument will be, well, you did it to us, back with the Affordable Care Act, now we're going to do it to you. And there's something very sick about winning is a wonderful thing. If you've been in athletics or not, or cowboying, or seeing the picture of him riding that damn horse, I've seen it all. But the point, winning is a wonderful thing, but now it's not about winning, it's rubbing your nose in it. And that is a very puzzling and vicious thing, and that's the way it goes right now.
Right. It just seems we got to get to the point where both in the Congress and our communities that you don't have to win everything. You know, a partial win is a win. You know, 75%, you don't have to have the whole loaf. You know, a partial loaf is success. But too often these days, people have to have 100%. You just can't back off. It's a total, gotta win. And some of the interest groups, pushing members of the Senate, are the same. Gotta win. Look at the heads of interest groups, the head of all these various organizations. They gotta justify their existence to their membership by taking the most extreme position to show to the membership that they're doing a good job for the membership. So they push for the most extreme position.
So the no new taxes pledge.
That's a good example. No new taxes. That's a very good example.
And, you know, if a member votes for a fee increase, it could be, well, that's a tax. And
right.
You just voted against your pledge. We're going to run a primary opponent
right.
against you.
And that's right.
Oh, yeah. If you're a Democrat and you start talking about entitlement reform or solvency of Social Security, you get a visit from somebody who said, we got a primary opponent for you. And if you're a Republican talking about revenue and taxes, they say, keep going, pal. We have a primary opponent for you, and that's where we are. And that is really, and then, of course, the great phrase of the politician is, we are fighting for you. No, they're not. They're fighting for the guys who are putting the squeeze on them in those interest groups. That's who they're fighting for, and it's... The tax code, Max knows too, there are 180 things in there called tax expenditures. Every one of them have a building in Washington, D.C. You think the realtors, I sleep with a realtor. I mean, she won't work anymore, but she's a wonder. 63 years with that beautiful woman right there. And boy, are they geared up now. They're just laughing now. They've got all their stuff in there, and America doesn't even know what's in there. But anyway.
I want to go back to something you said about it takes 6 to 8 years, roughly, to get an issue worked on, especially a tough issue, and immigration. This was an issue. You were working on a bipartisan panel that was working on immigration back in, if you can believe it, the mid-80s. And now they're talking, you know, the budget, they need to do something by the end of this week, right? Or we're chugging down toward a partial government shutdown. And one of the things the Democrats are talking about is we need to do something to shield child immigrants from deportation. Many of you know that as DACA. Yes, the wheels of government, particularly the Senate, which is geared to move deliberately, move slowly. But at what point, Al, is it just too slow?
Well, immigration, we worked hard on that, had joint hearings with Ron Mazzoli, the Democrat, in the House. We went to Tip O'Neill, said, why should we have a hearing in the Senate and one in the House on the same issue? Well, he said, nobody's ever come in here like that and asked for that. And we said, well, he's a Democrat and I'm Republican. We want to do it. And I think we had maybe 15 or 20 joint hearings. And we came out with a bill, and it passed the Senate, I don't know, 63. It was totally bipartisan. It got to the House, though. And oddly enough, the guy going down in flames right now, John Conyers, fought it just tooth and fang, along with Ed Roybal. Mm-hmm. And then the word got out from the right and the left, from Gover Norquist and his wizards to the ACLU, that don't you see they have a phrase in there, we need a more secure identifier. And the word then went around America that it was a national ID card. Well, Merry Christmas. When that baby hit and the American people bit into that one from the right and the left, they took that out of the bill. The bill had no consequence, because if you didn't have a more secure identifier, the employer couldn't be protected. So it was an interesting bill, and Reagan signed it, and it had no teeth at all. And then a Republican named Rubio tried to play with it, and they cut him to ribbons. So now it's just a, you know, it's just a big, you got to do something to give a legal status, not amnesty, to people who are here illegally because they are expendable and they're being used up. They don't have any human rights. And what's good about that? 11 million, 12 million, I don't know, but get them on a track to temporary, you know, permanent or whatever, whatever, which we tried to do.
Yeah,
but
I might say, Alan deserves a lot of credit. He worked very, very hard on immigration. Immigration is so complicated. My gosh, it's complicated. And Alan knows much more than I, but it just, whether it's H-1B visa problems or whether it's immigrants coming in from, you know, where, you name it, all these different interest groups all around the country trying to put together immigration, with the DACA is a large part of it. And I really take my hat off to you, Al. You really tried hard to get that bill passed.
You worked hard on everything did. That's the way it worked.
But the trouble is, you know, here we are with DACA. There's such a need for DACA. So is it going to be part of this new, you know, appropriations, or, you know, continuous resolution, on this bill? I don't know, but Democrats are going to push hard to get DACA in there.
Right. So let's talk a little bit about, you mentioned you were in the class of 1978. I mean, think about it, you know, for this audience, 1978, these gentlemen were elected to the U.S. Senate. How is this different? How is it different when you were first starting in office, in when you look at today, where negotiation, compromise, those aren't acceptable today? At least that's what I think the American public is hearing. It's no, this is, I'm planting my flag and this is it. 100%. I want 100%. Is that any different than when you were starting out in the U.S. Senate? What did your senior mentors tell you? How do you overcome this?
Well, there were some giants in the Senate when we got there, Democrat and Republican alike. Ribicoff, Chavez,
Mansfield,
Hatfield, Stennis, Long,
Baker.
And boy, we kind of bowed when they were by. There's no one you can look up to there now of any stature. You're just not there. But, you know, I was curious to meet Carl Levin. I had spent a year in Detroit. I wanted to meet Bill Bradley because I was an old jock. So I just went up and said hello, and we got to know each other. And we met once a month, just the members of the largest class in the U.S. Senate history. It was 20 of us. I think it was 9 Democrats and 11 Republicans, or vice versa, but a wonderful bunch. And we talked, and we visited, and we didn't immediately set up a feeling of, well, this guy is a Democrat. I mean, it meant no difference to me. I didn't care. I'd been in the state legislature, so had you. And you didn't. If you were that rigid, if you're a 100%er, you got heartburn, BO, and gas. And not only that, you smell bad.
One thing has changed a lot. When I arrived, Al arrived, to remember this. In the Senate, there's a Senate dining room. and just off the Senate dining room, yeah. It's a private senator's dining room. Just senators have lunch. No staff, no spouses, nobody but senators. We go in there, and I look forward to that lunch or that opportunity to sit down almost as much as anything during that day. I get to go over, and Al be there, and Jack Danforth and Big Who all be in there. We just let our hair down, talk about our kids, talk about vacations. It's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful. Well, guess what happened? Those lunches, that was open all the time. On Tuesdays, we Democrats had our party luncheon. And after a while, I got more involved in politics and less in policy. And we'd be saying, oh, those terrible Republicans down the hall. So we plot against those terrible Republicans down the hall because they're having their lunch at the same time and they're plotting against us down the hall. Well, our lunches were on Tuesdays. Then on Wednesdays, I don't know what you had, we had some kind of book club or something. I don't know what the hell it was. And on Thursday, we had something else. Pretty soon, the Wednesday lunches and the Thursday lunches were just as political as the Tuesday lunches. Mm-hmm. And we all go to these political lunches, plotting how we're going to take on the other party.
When was this? What year was this?
Oh, this grew over time.
Oh, okay.
Why did it grow over time? Fundraising. Because not only were we having our lunches Wednesday and Tuesday and all that political, but we'd be out during the noon hour raising money, fundraising. So guess what? That private senator's dining room closed. Nobody went anymore. Because we're all off on our political stuff. We're all off fundraising. We didn't just go to a place where we could just meet with each other and just be buddies and friends and talk.
There was one other thing, and I bet you've forgotten, I haven't. When they asked me to campaign against Tom Daschle in our neighboring state of South Dakota, and I said, to hell with that. I'm not going to do that. Never asked me to campaign against Max because we were running at the same time. I didn't have time to come up and do Max. But you remember, and it was Trent Lott, the leader at that time, who went to South Dakota and campaigned against Daschle.
Yeah.
No one had ever seen that before.
Well, Durenberger came to Montana and campaigned against me, and that's the first time I ever saw it. And I just, this is a harbinger for something coming
down
the road.
Did
yes,
Dave.
He did, yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well, you just didn't do that.
No, he didn't.
But boy, when that started, and then it never ended. What I noticed, you get back to the doing the commission on reform, deficit, and so on. Max was very helpful in all that. But so people would ask questions of you around the country. Well, who voted for that piece of crap? Well, you'd say, I'm sorry, sir, you felt that way about that bill, but it was 67 pages, and it was called The Moment of Truth, and it was written in English, and it had phrases like going broke and shared sacrifice. And somebody would say, well, who voted for it? And you'd say, well, Dick Durbin of Illinois. Dick Durbin, that commie from Illinois? You don't mean he voted for that. Well, Tom Coburn, that Neanderthal Republican from Oklahoma, that's your country. That's what's happened right now. And then these media folks who couldn't administer their way or govern their way out of a paper sack and know nothing about government and never will get you so worked up because you watch them day and night and they don't even know what the bill is or anything else, and neither do we. No one does. Just use emotion, fear, guilt, racism, what the hell.
What do you really think?
What? Wait a minute, I haven't ranted yet. Dan is sitting there, I may rant. I got that off my chest. It didn't have anything to do with the question, but Jesus, it felt good.
You feel better?
Yeah, I do.
In case you're just joining us, you're listening to a discussion on political discourse, what it's like today, what it's like when our two guests Former Senators Max Baucus and Al Simpson were in the U.S. Senate. You're listening to Yellowstone Public Radio. Thank you so much to our live audience here at Sissel Recital Hall on the campus of MSU Billings. I want to ask you, if hindsight, both of you, if hindsight is 2020, can you remember a time where either of you were uncivil?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you bet.
Do tell.
Oh, yeah, sometimes.
We were good at it.
Right. Yes.
All right, which one of you wants to tell? And how do you define uncivil?
I'm not proud of these moments, but several times, yes.
Yeah. And
I'd make it up. I'd go back. I'm sorry I said that. You know.
Was it just words in the heat of the moment? Just, was it a particular bill?
Just frustration.
Yeah, a lot of frustration.
And it's there, and it happens with all human beings. I think part of it is when people... this will get me in trouble. I think political correctness is stupid.
I agree.
I think half of the world's problems are people who really will say to you, do you know that I've never had an unpleasant thought about anyone, never had a bit of bias or prejudice? give me a big break, because all of us have bias and prejudice and feelings. And to say we don't, that stuff is like a fissure in a volcano, and it's going to come out somewhere. I think half the rage in the world is people giving you that BS that they never, ever had a bad thought. Boy, I tell you, that is disaster in my mind.
And I think it helped elect Trump.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
A lot of people think this country's become a little too politically correct in several areas, and that upsets a lot of people, a concern, and it creates some frustration, and that's part of the reason I think Trump got elected.
I really believe that. I certainly do believe that one. Mm-hmm.
So I want to follow up on something that both of you have said. There is a reluctance today for elected members of Congress from both the House and Senate to meet with the public in a public forum like this to exchange their dislikes and likes. Gee, Senator, you're a boob for voting for that bill. You've heard that.
Well, Max had town meetings. I watched him. I had them all the time.
Yeah.
But they're reluctant to do that today. Is some of that our fault? Because, and I say our, including the media as well as the public, because are we just following your lead? Or are you following our lead? I guess that's a question in this.
You jump in and get wet first.
Like most things, it's not black and white. It's shades of gray. I had town meetings constantly. In fact, I'll go so far as to say, if you did this, Al, I get elected in 78. My gosh, we had mobile offices around the state. And I was all for transparency, good government, and so on and so forth. And boy, you bet, we had town meetings all the time. Because my bosses, I would say many times, and boy, I really believe that. I'm so lucky. I had 900,000 of the world's best bosses. You know, the people of Montana. I'm just the hired hand. I'm just the employee. Voters, they're my bosses. So I'd go and we'd go have a little conversation. However, after a while, people on the other side would take advantage of the town meetings. They'd have the TV cameras there, and they had all their plants in the audience would just stand in front of the TV camera to berate me. Just one other. And guess what the evening news was? It's all the nasty stuff. It's all the nasty stuff. And it got to be a problem after a while. And so I asked myself, how do you handle all this? That's not good government. That's not an effort to try to have a dialogue and a constructive debate and how to go to the next step. How do you handle all that? My answer to that was, it's best. I didn't do it when I was there, but right now, if I were John Tester, if I were Steve Daines or whomever, I'd give some thought to say, okay, we'll still have the town meetings, the TV can be there, but not at the meeting. We'll have an interview just outside. Just try to take away the heat of the moment of the TV. I would experiment with that.
Tell the story. I don't know if everyone has heard the story about you were doing one of your work days. And guns. Do you remember this in Missoula?
Oh, yeah.
Tell the story. It's really interesting because...
Well, I don't want to take too much time here, but one thing I did, y'all may have done it too, one of the best parts of my job, I was in the Senate, one day a month I work at some job in the state, so 8 o'clock in the morning, my sack lunch, and I'd be there to work all day long. Not to watch, but to work. Wait tables, work in sawmills. I still water mine up here. I worked jack drill up one day and so forth. One day I was, no pun, riding shotgun with Zip beverage truck in Missoula. We're going around, delivering, you know, soda pop and beer and restaurants and taverns and so forth. At the end of the day, I was at the airport bar in Missoula, and some guy is sitting over the side over there, and so I, you know, that's my want. You know, I learned this from Al. I watched you once. You shook so many hands.
You never go into a bar at night.
No, no. But watching, I learned this from you, actually. And a big old guy sitting on the side, and walked up to him, shake his hand. I know who you are. And I said, well, let's talk. Big guy stood up and said, you want to come tonight? Tell us why you made them gun votes. Who are you? We're the Association to Protect the Second Amendment. How many people? About 200-300 people there. What time? 6:30. Make a long story short, I went. And sure enough, just whole crowd. Oh, God, he came after all. And I walked up, and I wanted the element of surprise. And I said to myself when I walked up, whatever happens, Max, you're going to keep your cool, you're going to keep your calm, you're not going to let anything get under your skin. So I walked up and said, I'll talk. He said, oh, no, we put you on a program later. I said, no, I changed my schedule. I want to speak now. He said, okay. So I stood in front of everybody. I said, all I ask is give me 5 minutes. Then we'll let all hell break loose. And to their credit, they let me speak for 5 minutes. I talked about guns and this and that. I'd voted for the Feinstein bill to ban manufacturing new assault rifles.
I didn't, but it was a gutsy vote up here.
And I voted for the Brady bill. And so as soon as I finished my 5 minutes, sure enough, all hell broke loose. Yeah. And I'd say the front half were all, not posse comitatus, but they were convinced that President Clinton was going to take away all our guns, and he had pre-positioned troops and armed forces out in the woods with the helicopters out there. They believed it. And so we talked a while. And about halfway through, saw a big guy way in the back of the room. He stood up. He said, Un-Senator Baucus. Because that is your name. You're an unsenator. You'll never be a senator again in your whole life. You're a disgrace to the state of Montana. You violate your oath of office to Montana, U.S. federal, et cetera. And I let him speak. And then I said, sir, I hear you. That's a position you hold very deeply, very sincerely. It's heartfelt. And I respect that. But I ask you to hear what I said and urge you to maybe understand that I have my view, which I hold quite sincerely and it's heartfelt. You could feel the tension in the room start to fall. Something happened in the room. And then pretty soon we got into political science-like discussion. Somebody jumped up and said, you believe in the 10th Amendment of the United States? Of course I believe in the 10th Amendment of the United States. Took oath of office to support the 10th Amendment. Oath of office to support the Second Amendment, all amendments, whole Constitution. Well then, if you support the 10th Amendment, why can't the states just take over everything? And I said, well, you know, if we did that, we wouldn't have...
But you're a lawyer.
Yeah. Anyway, then one guy said, so I said, we have a supremacy clause in the Constitution. Anyway, long story short, it really became more of a discussion than it was a debate and a dialogue. At the end, an hour later, I could not believe it. I got a standing ovation. Now, it wasn't the most exuberant in the world. But they all stood up. That was a lesson I learned. Respect. You respect the other person's point of view. And I've tried mightily ever since to just try to always listen and to respect and discuss. And I do think it's something we need more of. in our country.
That's a very good, I remember that very well, what happened there. I took the list of the weapons with me on the board, the Feinstein Amendment, and I went to the town meetings. I said, any of you have any of these? Nobody had one of those. Yeah, right. I mean, they were about, what she described, about 200 would shoot around corners at 500 rounds a second or something. And I said, well, then I think we could get rid of that and that. Oh, yeah. Let me tell you, cops would get up, retired policemen, people of respect. I said a really smart-ass remark. I said, what do? Take them out and shoot pumpkins in your field? Guy said, that's exactly what I do. And I like to shoot pumpkins in the field. So I didn't have the guts to play with that one, but I did have the guts to have town meetings right to the end, and I would speak for 5 minutes and stay for 2 hours.
Too. Yeah, same thing.
And let them rant.
Right.
In fact, if you let them rant, finally a guy has just got his neck muscles are sticking out and he's all red, and you know he's coming, and you let him go. But if he gets going, somebody will get up and say, shut up, I want a piece of him first. So I learned that one. That's a good one. And just stay. They are paying you.
True.
And then there'd be the guy that's saying, I don't like to talk in public, but here's an envelope, and you could read it when you get in the car. I said, thank you so much, and I don't want to upset you rotten. This is great.
I also learned at town meetings. You know, we had a long town meeting, and you want to just do your very best. And so I would say, well, anybody have some little nagging thought in the back of their mind they want to ask a question about? I learned after a while, those were often the toughest questions because people didn't want to ask it, so they finally did.
I used to say, I hate to take questions from the floor after I'm ready to go because they come off the wall.
your reaction to, Wyoming reminds me, just out of town here at Laurel, is during immigration.
Oh, yeah.
And one of my work days. I'm out there, I'm working at the refinery out there, and they have a lunch break, so I bring out my lunch and eat with the guys, mostly guys or gals there, and so on and so forth. And it's wonderful because that's when the ice would start to break. You know, they'd see me make a mistake working, I'd do something stupid and so forth, and then we start to talk a little bit. Well, anyway, when you ask me, so Baucus, what do you think about that immigration bill? And Bush was then president, and Bush was a little more moderate about immigration. He was trying to help put something together. So I started out by saying, well, I think President Bush is kind of the right track. Holy mackerel, hell broke loose. This guy took my head off. He was so angry. He says, I spending all this money for my daughter to go to school, and all these illegals are coming in. They're taking advantage of me and my daughter and so forth and so forth. And then the guy says, yeah, those illegals, we should electrify the fence, watch them fry when they try to climb the fence. I mean, it was a kind of vitriol that immigration generated, and to some degree still does, but it's you just gotta deal with it, you listen to it. And
my dad was campaigning in the sugar beet factory down in Torrington one day, and the guy came up and said, Simpson, I wouldn't vote for you if you were Jesus Christ. The old man said, if I was Jesus Christ, you wouldn't be in my precinct. You got to handle it, but you got to stay cool. And when you lose your cool, your friends will tell you.
Yeah, it's over.
I've done that a few times, and I get a call from a guy really that I loved, known for 30, and he said, Al, you really went too far. That woman was asking, or that man was asking, a serious question, and you didn't answer it and got a little smart. Like, boy, you learn fast.
I'm curious. Al, I have to ask you this because the book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, puts a lot of blame on Republicans
I was going to ask Al about that.
You know, so this book by Thomas Mann and Norm Ornstein. Their book, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, and then crossed out was. Puts a lot of blame on Republicans for the current state of disarray, I don't know, whatever you want to call it, that's happening right now in the Congress. And he says, he points to the Gingrich Revolution. A lot of those House members went to the Senate and brought that culture with them.
Sure.
The Republicans' acceptance of an extreme ideology, and then disdain for negotiation and compromise. Would you agree?
Well, compromise to many is a four-letter word. And I love to get the guys in the corner, you know, I'll say, do you believe in the Constitution? You know, and boy, you know, they fall flat on their head. And then this Bill of Rights, how about that? Yeah, yeah. And I mean those things. And the Declaration and the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, if you've been a veteran, I was a veteran, there's a lot of difference in the opinion of people watching people stand or sit when you're a veteran, I'll tell you that much for sure. But it, what the hell was I going to say? It was beautiful. your key was
Republican, you know, Party.
Republican. Yeah, you know, if the Republicans.
Oh, yeah. Well, there's the thing. The Republicans have slipped over into social issues that are so divisive. I am now known as a rhino Republican in name only. And I thought Republicans had a pretty simplistic view. Government out of your life, the precious right of privacy, and the right to be left alone. How does that equate with things that are red hot? Issues like abortion, and gays, and lesbians, and transgendered bathrooms? How does that equate? How does it equate with the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, with liberty and justice for all? The word is all at the end. Well, yeah, but what about justice? Well, justice for a pedophile would be prison. That's justice. But let's get serious here. So Republicans go down in flames on this stuff. I was watchdog of the Treasury Award. You won that. Small Business Awards. I made a parquet floor out of those things. There was those plaques. And yet, I'm a rhino because I believe very deeply, just as you can do, and I did, that abortion is a terrible thing. I'd hate to have to be making the decision or involved in it, but it's a deeply intimate and personal decision by a woman, and I don't think men legislators should even vote on it. No. Nobody has ever clapped for anything I've ever said. But let me tell you, we all know or love somebody who's gay or lesbian. We all know or love somebody who's gay or lesbian. What is this all about? In transgendered bathrooms, just hang a sign on the outhouse that says single occupancy only and quit the crap.
Now, you'll get in trouble.
No.
Well, I mean, I have to ask you, Al, because, what? I mean, you were a whip. And you were, I mean, in the book, it's even worse than it looks. You're called a conservative now. You're a rhino.
I was a conservative.
Republican in name only.
And then the other day in a debate, the guy said, you can't be a fiscal conservative and a social liberal. I said, why not? Well, you can't. So, when you're dealing with people, it's a tough one. People don't have time to learn the complexity of an issue, so you either listen to Rachel Maddow or Rush Babe or Glenn or somebody pumping crap into your head, and you want to believe the ones that are pumping your kind of crap. And you don't like to hear the other side.
Sure.
And if you did hear it, you'd rail against it. But these guys, as I say, they're entertainers. They're making millions off of you. They don't have any idea of what the legislation is, and so when they're killing town meetings, go ask them what they're doing. Well, you go look, and they've passed 20 bills or 30 bills. Max Baucus and Enzi and Grassley used to pass bills, but they weren't, you know, high drama on the wall, but they made America run.
Right, highway bill and so forth.
Well,
so,
yeah.
You know, as we're kind of moving toward the conclusion of this show, I have to ask you.
So, ask Max.
I'll ask Max. So, you know, politics is often described as a contact sport. We've got 2018 elections right on the horizon. all of our U.S. House races, our U.S. Senate races are nationalized. It's not just Montanans or Wyomingites voting.
Right.
So it's almost become, as the both of you have suggested, a blood sport. And it's almost taken on this Shakespearean cast where at the end of the day, there's blood on the floor. Is there anything that we can do about this, or are we just doomed as a country?
Well, let me try to slide to that a bit obliquely. Mel and I have spent the last 3 years in China. And China's economy is going to exceed that of the U.S. in not too many years down the road. We're going to be number two. China's going to be number one. China is growing very quickly. Authoritarian government, they got a vision, a sense of where they're going, not a democracy, but they've got a bit in their mouth, they've got a bounce in their step, they'll be hubris, and they're moving along. Here we are at home, and to some degree I sometimes think it's like Nero. I mean, we're kind of fiddling to some degree where the countries should be focusing on something a little more important, basic, and we're letting ourselves get all wrapped around the axle and all the local politics and this and that. And, you know, it's fun, it's entertaining, it gets us exercised and so on and so forth. But I'm just a little concerned, frankly, that we're not realizing when we get involved in all this, the degree to which our kids and our grandkids might be facing a country and a world which is a little bit different from what we've enjoyed. We're so lucky to be Americans. We have an immigration policy in the United States because Americans don't want to leave. They're not heading for the door. Other people want to come and live in America. It's because we are still, you know, the place to live. So I just hope that we start thinking a little more seriously about our future and our kids and grandkids, and realize how lucky we are now, so that we are more likely to think more seriously and with a more sober way about what's going on, and maybe start listening to the other side a little bit more, knowing we got a bigger problem in our hands than we might otherwise realize. I'm also very struck, I read a book a long time ago, it's Paul Kennedy, The Rise and Fall of Nations. You know, in history of the world, civilizations have risen and fallen. Greeks, Romans, Egyptians, they rise and fall. Here we're America, we're only about 250 years old. What's the guarantee? The United States of America is going to continue to grow and prosper, and we're not going to fall the same fate as some other countries did. It's inevitable. Something's going to happen sometime. But what do we do in our country to keep going and rising and just being the country we like to think that we are? And I come down to a couple things. Number one, two conditions. One is a very educated electorate. Democracies take work. It's hard work. It's not automatic. You got to work at getting information, know who's right and who's not right. Not just accept what somebody else says. Not just accept what's on the radio or on TV or something. You got to work at it and find out. It's hard work, but you got to work at it and find out what's the better answer, what's more likely answer, the constructive answer, you know, to that issue. And second, you've got to do something about it. You can't just sit in your rear end. Get involved, work what you believe in, because in a democracy, it takes work, and honest, hard work, constructive work, if we're going to solve some of this.
That's good stuff. And you know, it didn't start in Congress. I mean, I get the old Gazette every morning. I mean, you know, I can read and write. And you know, there's issues there that come before this community about diversity and gays and lesbians and things like that, and discrimination and school boards that love to fight, and Cody's got plenty of that. We're now the cycle of watching whether you can have guns in your school with the administrators and the teachers having an appropriate permit to carry them. That debate is going on in Cody, and everybody in the country is looking at district number 6 to see, and I don't know where that will go. I deeply believe in the Second Amendment, I was on federal probation for shooting mailboxes. I remember it well. But I'll tell you, it didn't start in Congress. It starts in school boards and city councils. The chief of the fire department, Casper, sending out crude text messages, sexist messages. This thing, God knows where this baby's going, but I'll tell you, it ain't going to end, and it's going to draw a deep net, and then we're going to get into definitions. What is sexual harassment?
Yes.
And that's in the eye of the beholder. That's in the eye of the person. But when Jefferson said, I'd rather, what he said, if it was a case of newspapers versus government, free press versus government, I would unhesitatingly select the papers, the newspapers, but they forget the next part, but they must be able to read and understand them, and they don't. They're tangled up in their lives. A kid's doing pot, the old man loses his job. These people aren't paying attention. How can they? And when they're not paying attention, they're listening to the wizards out there who use emotion, fear, guilt, and racism all day long to confound them and devil them. And it's tough to watch. And so the town meetings, why would you want to come? They hold up an empty chair and say, where is Enzi, or where is Barrasso, where is Liz Cheney? You know, well, I tell you, they're probably in downtown trying to do something, but this is bad stuff, and you have to respect Ornstein, and they wrote the book, The Sapless Branch, years ago. But I...
homework.
I hear homework for the
crowd.
I see our time's running off. I might just say one thing and jump in here. It's the role of the media in all this. And it's the question of false equivalence. The, media has to be fair, they think. On the one hand, this, the other hand, that. One hand, this, the other, that. This party, they're to blame. That party has to be blamed. Balance. I think the media's got to examine that question much more deeply. When should we move beyond balance and call it like it is?
Truth.
And it's in the print media, as well as NPR, as well as the mainstream media. We all have an obligation. And you are so powerful in so many ways. Maybe you have a little extra obligation. And I just urge that message to be thought about among those in the media. Because my personal view is you got to be straight, you got to be honest, not to worry too much about anyone and this and that. No, because it's kind of boring. It's not accurate.
You don't want to play with truth too much, because both parties, both presidential, all presidential candidates said they would run on the basis of not ever touching precious Social Security and precious entitlements. And ladies and gentlemen, that's a third of the American budget. True. So go ahead and don't touch it, and it will eat up everything you love. Education, defense, the whole works, all the discretionary budget. What the God's sake, if you can't change the retirement age to 68 by the year 2050, and the AARP said, how will old people ever be able to figure it?
All that's we got to run. All that's very true. But we had to have an honest discussion about that, and unfortunately, the other side, Republicans, said, oh, you can't include Texas as part of that.
That's right.
And unfortunately, we are running out of time.
I know, I can tell.
So I want to thank everyone in the audience for joining us for this forum to discuss the role of civility in politics. And welcome to Cecil Recital Hall on the campus of MSU Billings. Special thank you to our guests, Senators Max Baucus and Al Simpson. Jamie Granzilla was our sound engineer, Jim Nichols our technical director, Rob Massey led the team of Patrick Williams and Wesley Jessen for the YouTube stream. Good night.